The SparkFile podcast may contain profanity and other adult content.
Please use your discretion.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my SparkFile. Could be something that I want to make or how I want to be. I pump it in my SparkFile. I jump into my SparkFile. Let's open up the SparkFile.
Welcome to the SparkFile, where we believe that everyone is creative, but no one creates alone.
I'm Laura Camion.
And I'm Susan Blackwell. If you're an OG listener, welcome back, Sparkler. If you're joining us for the first time, know that all are welcome here.
Whether your creativity has been on pause during this time, or if you've clung to it like a lifeline, welcome.
Welcome. But you may be asking yourself, what exactly is a spark file? Where do I get a spark file? What do I file in a spark file? These are such good questions, and we actually do have answers.
Mm-hmm. A spark file is a place where you consistently collect all your inspirations and fascinations.
Here's the deal. We are makers who make all kinds of things.
If you're anything like us and you're making stuff all the time or want to be making stuff all the time, you know the wellspring of inspiration can run a little dry, especially now.
But do not despair. We are on the lookout for fresh ideas, images, and inspiration that spark our creativity and pique our curiosity, things that inspire us to get up off of our asses and make things like this podcast.
Or a new holiday display for your front yard.
I'm here for it. Or a commitment to strengthening our ability to bounce back.
Every episode, we're going to reach into the spark file and exchange some sparks. And from time to time, we're going to talk to some folks who spark us, too.
And if you're not careful, you might just breathe some new life into yourself. So without further ado, let's open up the spark file. Guess what time it is, Cam?
It's spark file time.
It's spark file time. It's season two time. We're not messing around this time, though. This isn't a teaser. This isn't a catch up. This is us.
Seuss.
We're back in the saddle, Cams.
We're like legit, for real, back in the saddle. This saddle is so ill-fitting at the moment that I even messed up that little bit in the intro. I'm like, oh, this saddle, I totally forgot.
Did you mess up? I didn't notice anything.
We usually lightly refer, we sort of tease. I don't know if you haven't figured out that, listeners. We sort of tease what's coming up. And I did my holiday display. And then after that, I was like, oh, yeah, we tease things here. This is a spot where we tease things. It's been a little while, and I'm just removing the cobwebs right now. Yeah.
But yeah. I feel like we just live in the realness. We just live where we are. And this is where we are. So much has happened since the last time.
I forgot the format.
You forgot the format. You remembered the format. We have elected a new president and a new vice president.
That's big.
It's big. I feel more hopeful, more optimistic.
Yes.
And that makes me feel more energetic and creative.
100%. I think we needed to feel and see a light at the end of the tunnel, that there was something that was going to affect some change, because we can't go on as we were. It was just this year, for one, has been so full of so many hardships. There had to be a indication that we were going to get on a track to heal and improve our situation.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting to see. This is our moment. We're recording this, I would say, about 24 hours after the election results came out. So we're still basking in the glory of that. But there is so much. There's so much that has to be done, and so many things that have to be addressed. And that work is that is coming, but right now we're just still floating on a cloud. Yes.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of work to be done, and that's why it's so good to be creative, because we need to be creative about how we're going to address some of this stuff.
It's so true. Some creative problem solving is going to come in handy.
Yeah. I think we're in it for the coming, I don't know for how long, but I feel like the current president is, I keep thinking of him like an animal, like a wild animal that has been wounded, but is still like ranging and roaming. And I'm nervous that he's going to be even more sort of unpredictable and dangerous. And,
yeah,
it'll be interesting to see. I was reading a thing that said he's going to be lashing out against the people who did this to him, namely us, the American people. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be interesting to see how that manifests. But I don't want to give over to that fear.
You don't have to energize that.
I'm not going
to
energize that.
Much.
I'm going to energize my optimism and possibility.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. There are people willing to do the work that you mentioned, you know, all of us included. Like I think everyone's got eyes wide open. There's work to do. And I'm very thankful that we're in it with people who are willing to do the work.
Yes. And speaking of work to do, I just want to shout out all of our friends, like friends of the podcast, friends who have like really used their creativity and put muscle behind Erica Henningsen.
Yes.
Erica Henningsen, getting out first-time voters.
Yes.
I just think of so many people, Celia, Keenan Bulger, people who were like out there making it happen, phone banking, just really throwing their...
Karen Olivo, yes.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
Many.
It was just an absolute thing of beauty to see.
So many friends like doing the text campaigns, the letter postcard campaigns, every bit of it. You know, we've talked before about there's so many ways to contribute, whether it's like giving $5 whenever those texts come through, or it's being on the other end of like sending the texts and the letters, or being out holding up signs outside. But whatever your level of comfort, you know, your engagement level, you're making a difference.
Yes,
everyone contributed
absolutely.
To an overall change.
Yeah. And speaking of people that, so funny, I have a few stories to tell you. First of all, a friend of ours who is, I'm going to say like a world famous celebrity, who I won't
glamorous.
Name because I don't have their permission to tell the story, but this person was doing a lot of campaign work via text, and they would just sign their first name. So, you know, if you've received those texts that are like, hey, this is blank, I'm fighting for Joe Biden, and I'm wondering if we can count on you for blank. They were doing that, and they were using their real first name, but I thought, how funny and how thrilling would it be for people if they knew that, like,
who that
movie
was.
Stars? Yes, people who are doing that work. Yeah,
amazing.
Because a lot of those people aren't necessarily like working right now, and so they wanted to use this time and throw it behind this very, very vital work, which I loved. And yes, people
amazing.
Who made it happen, people who use their creativity. People who took disappointment and turned it into, took their Helen back and made it their gift. I want to talk about Stacey Abrams.
I was just going to say the word Stacey.
Yes.
Abrams.
How about Stacey Abrams? I'd like to see Stacey Abrams in the White House.
Yes, indeed.
I feel like
that's in her future.
Oh,
I feel like that's going to happen. I really
what
do.
What Stacey Abrams accomplished is extraordinary. And of course,
and
she didn't
talk,
do it alone.
She didn't do it alone, but we often talk, because we're fascinated with this topic of failure or perceived failure.
That's
and
right.
This is a woman who did not win her race, came very, very close, and now just turned around, took all that energy, and helped Biden-Harris win the White House. And what, you know, like it's really all about what you do with the experience of, you know, do you shrink away and say, oh, I guess I, you know, I guess yeah. I failed at this, or, you know, do what you did and turn it completely, or do what she did and turn it on its side and say, oh, okay, I've got a lot of power here. My voice is being heard, and I'm going to utilize it to make change.
It is an amazing example of let me try that again. Let me extend the story and rewrite the ending. But I don't think it's an ending for Stacey Abrams.
It's not.
I don't know. I just think when there are people, I don't know, that capable, that smart, that are fighting so hard for the powers of good, it's inspiring.
It's inspiring.
It's so sparkish. It is so good. What else do I want to tell you? You know, one of my greatest challenges in life is how to get back to shit that I'm trying to find later, which is why it's good to have a spark file. Mm-hmm. But just now I was like, where did I put that? And it was, I put it at the top of my spark file so I'd find it.
And then you couldn't find it.
That's right.
Classic.
Okay. So this is on a completely different topic.
Okay.
So, sometimes if you're listening for the first time, welcome. This is not a political podcast. This is actually a creativity podcast. But we like to, when we see a spark that we've covered before, when we see a little update, we like to share it. And I saw this tweet over the summer when we were on our little breaky poo, and I've been holding on to it because I wanted to share it with you. This is an update to, it's not an update. It's more like a fun side spark to our episode that we did. I did a Halloween episode last year about Mercedes McCambridge and how she provided the voice of the devil in the movie The Exorcist. So we talked a lot about William Peter Blatty, who wrote the book The Exorcist. And I saw this tweet and I was like, I've got to share this with Camion. So this was tweeted by someone named Nelsonomicon, is their Twitter handle, at Nelsonomicon. And the tweet said, since The Exorcist is trending, I think it's a good time to repost this wonderful anecdote from William Peter Blatty. And here's the anecdote. It's very brief. When I worked at BMP, the head of television commuted in from Brighton every day. He started reading The Exorcist on the train. He said he thought it was the most evil book he'd ever read. In fact, he said it was so evil, he couldn't finish it. So at the weekend, he went to the end of Brighton Pier and threw it as far as he could. So I went to the bookshop, I bought another copy, I ran it under the tap, and I left it in his desk drawer for him to find.
That is awesome.
That's
amazing.
Made me laugh so hard. I don't know if it's true, but I thought it was really, really, really fucking funny.
Oh, that's good.
Come on. That's good.
That's creative right there.
That's a creative prank.
Creativity at work.
I enjoyed that very much. But anyway, is there anything else, Cams, before we dig into our spots?
I think we've covered it. I think we're up to date. This is, you know, up to the moment reporting here.
No.
What?
We haven't even, oh my gosh, the workshop. We haven't even talked about the workshop. So on January 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, we are going to be hosting the Spark File 2021 Creativity Kickoff. Mm-hmm. Cams, how would you describe it?
First of all, it's going to like jumpstart your creativity into the next year. It's going to solidify and determine like your creative path for the year. It's going to
absolutely
make sure that you prioritize first thing, January 1st. This will be a year of creativity for you.
And the cool thing is, because of the pandemic, it is going to be virtual. So you can join us from anywhere in the world. As long as you can Zoom yourself in, you can join us. And it's going to be, I know sometimes we can all get like Zoom fatigue and Zoom numbed out, but this is going to be more like an active virtual retreat. I think it's going to be so yummy and so delicious. And we have been leading these virtual workshops with people, and they don't leave like, my eyes are crossed. They leave so excited and so ready to continue rocking. So that's coming up, and there'll be more information about that at thesparkfile.com. Mm-hmm. The Sparkfile! What did you say? What was the verb you just used? You can what around?
Goof around.
Goof around. I talked over it for a second. I thought you said dick around. And I was like, that doesn't sound like something Camion would say.
Not usually, but I suppose it's possible.
This is the new fresh attitude you're bringing to season two.
Fuck around and find out. Yeah.
Whoa.
That's a new phrase that I just learned. There were like some signs in regard to like Philadelphia, not to bring it back to politics, but there were some signs that Wes was showing me. There were some really funny things. And I don't know where this phrase came from, but someone had the sign that said, fuck around and find out. And
what does that mean?
I think it means try me. You think I won't do that? Fuck around and find out. I think that's what it means. Oh, that's what I've adapted it. No, I was like, Wes, I'm going to keep
and
that.
Find out. I want a t-shirt that says that, except part of me wants, I want to be the person that would wear that t-shirt, but I actually probably wouldn't be the person.
I totally wouldn't. Just like I wouldn't say dick around, but right now I can laugh about saying it.
I swear to God, that's
it,
what you just
totally
said.
Wouldn't.
Roll the clip. Roll the tape.
I'm gonna goof around.
When I edit this episode, I'm gonna go back and I'm gonna ADR that on you so that you actually do
something. And then here I am claiming, no, I didn't. I swear.
It's because you're a liar. No, just kidding.
I feel a little giddy, to be honest. I feel a little drunk with excitement to
power
get back to
and
power.
To get back.
I mean, always. I'm always drunk with power.
Oh my God.
But
fuck around and find out is my new favorite.
Fuck around and find out. I really loved it. I laughed so hard. I don't know why. And I was like, what does this have to do with Philadelphia? Like, I was like, is that a thing? Is that a phrase? And Wes was like, I don't know, but we were too busy laughing. So
God, that's funny. That's really, really funny. last thing I said before the fight broke out. I love that. all right. Should we dig in?
Yeah.
Do you want to spark it up?
Yeah. I'll go first.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. I'm so excited right now. But I'm getting myself back into the mindset of when I wrote this spark. And the truth is Suze, I struggled a lot during this time of, the break that we took. And I'm really, really glad we took a break. For those of you who know us, you know, like we didn't really break. We've been working on a lot of workshops and a lot of behind the scenes work, if you will.
Yeah.
We just took a break from the podcast. But we needed essentially to, you know, prioritize resting and restoring and replenishing all the things that we talk about, like refilling the fish pond. And I'm glad we did that. But as we approached the launch of season two, I can't lie, actually. I'm not a liar. There were...
Look around and find out.
I always think about you when people... Sometimes I'm on Zoom, people will be like, Laura, your face. And I'm like, I was thinking something. And I think about you because... You're like, you don't have a poker face. If I'm thinking it, it's on my face.
It's a gift for us. It's a gift as an actor. Like, it's great. But you...
In real life.
You Laura Camion, have to know that you kind of wear it on your sleeve.
Yeah, I reveal it all.
Yeah.
So since you can't see my face right now, I will reveal to you that as we approach season two, there were moments that I was really wondering about our mission, and we've always been clear about it. And I love it. It's to help ourselves and help others fear less and create more.
Yeah.
And we genuinely believe in the power of creativity. But in my darkest moments, this pandemic kind of had me wondering about how relevant creativity is, to be honest. You know, I felt like the world had changed since we launched, and there were moments when I really doubted whether or not creativity was the answer. There were so many pressing issues like social injustice and climate change and the divisiveness of our country. I just was like, is encouraging creativity helpful? You know? And I didn't think this all the time, but it's just enough that I noticed it, you know, had crept in there. Sorry, you go ahead. You were going to say something.
I was just going to say that I hear you. I feel you. And also as you're speaking, I'm thinking, how are any of these things going to be addressed and solved? Mm-hmm. It's going to have to be through some form of applied imagination, aka creativity.
100%.
So creativity doesn't always mean like, and then I made, I took this paper and I made a bouquet of flowers out of it, or I painted this picture. Creativity is also like things like problem solving.
I know. Yeah. All of that. Like I'm 100%. I'm so with you. And I didn't think this all the time, but I, as we approached this episode, I was just like, I'm just seeing this little stream of doubt. I'm seeing that it had crept in and I need to explore this so I can put this away. You know what I mean? So I can just put it to rest. Like what is this exploration?
Yes.
So,
yes,
you know, we've talked many times about how creatives were using their talents and their creativity to fight injustices. We even talked to Bonnie Siegel about her book, Signs of Resistance, where she literally chronicles how artists and graphic designers have either unified or captured an entire movement, even contributed to its impact through the design of an image or a work of art. So obviously I know the power is there, but I also felt this need to go deeper and explore it a little bit further. I felt sparked to find out more ways that creativity was used for the power of good. Mm-hmm. And in this case, you know, when you're harvesting sparks, like sometimes a spark finds you, but sometimes you really need a spark and you go searching for it specifically. And so this spark is, this is just a few of the things I found when I went in search of the value of creativity.
Oh my God, I love this.
Thanks.
I believe in creativity in so many of its forms, but sometimes when life is really challenging, it can feel like a luxury or an indulgence.
That's right.
That's right. And I love that you're cracking this open.
Well, I'm going to do my best. I'm going to share with you some things I found in search of. Also, I wanted to use the phrase in search of. Do you remember those TV shows?
I think that's a show you really loved.
I loved it in school. They used to, you know, put those on. It would be like in search of Roanoke Island or something.
Oh my God. That sounds like a day when the teacher was a hungover and was just like, today we're going to have video day.
That is correct. And I loved it. I absorbed every bit of it. Still fascinated by Roanoke Island. I need to do a spark about that, by the way.
Oh, that is that's a good spark.
Yeah, I think they just discovered a settlement near there that might explain what happened to it. So I'll dig into that.
What?
That'll be for...
You're kidding.
Yeah.
I've heard nothing of this, but we've been a little busy. And the news cycle has been captured by other stories.
That's right.
That's amazing. I would love to hear that.
Yeah, I put it in my Spark file. So we'll circle back on that one. But here we are today,
right now.
And the value of creativity.
Creativity.
Yes. So I came across an article in Forbes written by Amanda Porsche. And Amanda describes herself as a highly sensitive autistic female. As an autistic person, she said, she thrives on routine and sudden change can be literally catastrophic.
Wow.
So, of course, we all know our world turned on a dime in March 2020. And for Amanda, who lived in New York, she lost the routines that served her, and they served as her coping mechanism. She lost her job, her ability to see friends, family, attend her support groups, and it became very bleak, very fast for her.
That would be hard for anybody, but it would be especially hard if it's really that sort of abrupt change is even tougher on you.
That's right. That's right.
Amazing. Yeah.
And in this article, she describes hearing what she called the death sirens of the ambulances, sometimes up to 200 sirens a day.
Ugh.
She describes seeing bodies in body bags, being put into U-Haul trucks and things got especially bad when she saw her neighbor being put into an ambulance.
Oh my gosh.
It was just a very, very scary and isolating time. And during that time, she felt, you know, she felt despondent at first, but then began drawing and painting. And according to Forbes, Amanda described feelings of rage, uncertainty, anxiety, fear about her own mortality, and found that starting an unplanned art project was the only thing that brought her any relief. Wow. She said, I would often start painting or drawing with no outlines, plans, or expectations. It was as if I let my feelings take the lead. If I messed up, I would just continue and turn my work into something entirely different.
Mm.
She got to the point where she was creating one work of art each day. She began posting the work online. She had offers to purchase her work, but more importantly, she found that it resonated with others. She often painted her feelings about being isolated from other people, and then to find that so many other people felt the same way. I found that so interesting because it really was the gift that keeps on giving, because just the sheer creation of the work was therapeutic for her. But then finding out that she was not alone in her loneliness was an added bonus, you know, an unexpected bonus.
Yeah.
In fact, Amanda wasn't doing any of this for anyone else. It was sheer survival for her. She said, I don't care how my work looks or who likes it. I do it for myself. I do it for my own sanity and survival. With COVID-19, we've learned that humans have very little control. Nature will do as it pleases. Art allows me to have some control back in my life.
Mm.
Amanda's now looking to going into school, going back to school and learning more about careers in the arts. She said, I would even go so far as to say, art saved my life. Now art is my life. I was really inspired by her story because it's a simple, like, you know, as individuals, I think we often, you know, we just, when someone makes like some huge thing that captures the entire world's imagination, we're like, oh, okay, all the praise gets heaped on that one person. But every single day, there are people who are literally surviving on creating art and being creative. And it's not for anyone else. It's for themselves. Yeah. And I just thought she was one of those, just a piece of evidence about how, you know, a simple practice like that could help you keep it together during, you know, a time that could have been catastrophic for her.
Yeah, I love that.
So
I'd love to see her art too. I'm so curious about what it looks like.
You totally can. I will post her Instagram page when we post this episode. I'll share her Instagram page as well.
Yeah. Awesome. Is it like abstract? Is it like, as you were talking, I was like, I wonder if it looks like Helma off Klint. I wonder if it looks like things are just moving through her and she's just
It's a little more like, who was it that did the Scream one?
Munch? Edvard Munch?
Yeah. Like she has some where that's what it spoke to me in that realm of sort of silent scream. She had one called The Pandemic Scream.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's, rage.
It's powerful.
That's amazing. Yeah. I can't wait to see it.
Yay. So I was inspired by Amanda's story, but nonetheless, I continue to gather evidence in favor of our beloved creativity. Next, I read about group programs that use art and creativity to help various populations of people. In California, 4 prisons participated in arts programs for their prisoners. And I know they're not alone in this. I know they happen everywhere, but now I'm like passionate about supporting them.
Oh my God, yes.
These 4 prisons studied the results of these classes and then published what they learned in the Justice Policy Journal. And the following programs were created, and they include 1, the Actors Gang Prison Project at the California Rehabilitation Center.
Really?
That was led by Tim Robbins' Actors Gang.
Yeah.
If you recall, he starred in Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah.
the Marion Shakespeare Theater Program, as well as a poetry class at San Quentin State Prison, a visual arts class at the Correctional Training Facility, and a writing course at New Folsom State Prison. So what they were hoping to do was quantify whether or not participation in fine arts activities could be transformative. And here's what they found. Regardless of years in the program, nearly everyone said that art helps them express themselves, relieve stress, feel happier, be creative, and make better choices. Most also reported that art helps them to better understand themselves and to work with others. And a majority of participants reported they got along better with other inmates while pursuing their art, and they liked themselves better the longer they were in the program. Never underestimate the power of liking yourself.
Oh my God, my head is sparking sparks. There are cartoon sparks sparking out of my ears right now.
Sparking out of your head. I mean, that makes me so happy. And I read a little further. Interestingly, Tim Robbins, who, as I mentioned, played a prison inmate in the 1994 film, yes, The Shawshank Redemption.
Yes.
He says he may actually get more out of the Actors Gang prison project than the inmates do. He's very actively involved in the project. And in an article for BBC News, he said, "This is so much more fulfilling to be in this struggle and this exploration than it any other like $1,000 plate dinner fundraiser I'd been to." This is so interesting.
Yes,
he said,
yes.
It puts that other crap that people in this industry deal with into perspective. Where am I? Who am I? What's my last movie? How successful am I? What's my current rating? It's a nightmare, really, a self-obsessed nightmare of survival in Hollywood. And here was an opportunity to throw all that away and figure out how to help this dude. And if you can get through to this guy, like, what an amazing feeling to be able to see someone change from a darkened, negative, shut-off person into a sentient human being and potential leader of men. And I thought it was so, so interesting because it's a little bit of what he's kind of talking a little bit about what you said. Like, there's the luxury and perhaps overindulgence of inner exploration. And then there's the use of art to help others, you know?
Yes, yes, yes.
Like sometimes art can be healing, I think, because we go inward and explore our own feelings. And sometimes we can use art as a way to get out of self-obsessed thoughts and put the focus on other people.
That is so great.
So again, there's like benefits from like multiple angles.
Can I add some sparks to those sparks?
Yes, yes. Add some sparks.
So a few things. This is a spark I've had in my file for a while, and I should trot it out. I just want to figure out the best way to bring it to y'all listeners. But Ear Hustle is really one of my, I'm going to say, top two favorite podcasts.
Mm-hmm.
It is made in the Media Lab at San Quentin.
Yep.
And it is so, I hope I'm not jumping your spark, but it is so good. It is so freaking good. And I love it so much. I learned so much from it about so many different things. So I'd love to here's a spark spoiler, like share that with people. If you're not already tuned into Ear Hustle, it's so good. But also on our little breaky poo, I had the opportunity to interview a really interesting human being named Kenyatta Hughes, who was incarcerated for decades. And he was in Sing Sing, and he was part of a program that was sponsored by Carnegie Hall. Mm. And they brought a very, she's, you know, a very famous, very significant opera diva named Joyce DiDonato to work with the incarcerated men at Sing Sing. And she worked with them on musical composition. And Joyce and Kenyatta met and began collaborating while he was incarcerated. And he is such a spark. Maybe I should just save this and we should just have him as a guest.
Well, because, yeah.
Yeah, he's just, I just see the way that creativity can really do all the things that you just described to help people understand their lives, to help people understand
like themselves.
And like themselves and have something really purposeful to do with their lives.
When we talk about transformation, I mean, is there like any more perfect example than these programs? Like, you're literally trying to help someone transform their life and what's possible for them once they leave prison, for them to change their vision for their life and what they're capable of. I mean, it's really powerful. It's really powerful.
Yeah. Oh my God. This spark is giving me life.
I'm so excited. And I'm excited to explore that spark even further and hopefully So another program that caught my attention is a joint effort between Northwestern University and the Looking Glass Theater Company that seeks to increase the quality of life for patients living with Alzheimer's, dementia, and other memory-affected disorders. Yes, it's called the Memory Ensemble, and they use improv techniques and activities to draw upon memories that are still accessible. And if they're not accessible, they utilize the opportunity to create a new memory on the spot. Which I just think is amazing. The motto of this class is, I am a creative person. When I feel anxious or uncertain, I can stop, breathe, observe, and use my imagination.
Oh.
I mean, if that's not like applying your imagination, like in any moment, in any circumstance, I loved this motto for the class, but
say it again?
Yes,
I will. Will you say it one more time? Yeah.
Yes. So I think it's a fantastic motto for anyone, anytime.
I feel like this kind of speaks to something in my spark, and I want it printed on the inside of my eyelids. So go ahead and say it again.
Here it is.
Okay.
I'm a creative person.
Mm-hmm.
When I feel anxious or uncertain.
When I feel anxious or uncertain.
I can stop, breathe, observe, and use my imagination.
I can stop, breathe, observe, and use my imagination. And is that to say, Camian, that I can imagine and create sort of like, I can disrupt that and create what I want the next moment to be?
I think it can mean that. For me, it really sparked me because I think of like everyday moments when we may not be conscious of using our creativity, but it is there to be had. Mm. Like if we trust, to me, it's like if we trusted our brains, like if you're, let's say you're afraid you might get called on in class, or you might get called on in a meeting to provide an answer that you're unsure about, you can stop, breathe, observe, and use your imagination. Mm. And just know that your brain is going to be there for you. I think it really builds that trust in yourself and your own abilities. Because I imagine, like, if you have dementia, even if you're in a moment where you feel present, the fear that it might get whisked away, you know, that you can't trust your brain, basically, that, you know, that... you might be put on the spot and you might not be able to find the words or find the memory. And I think that it does an amazing job of building that trust. Like, I can stop and breathe, observe, and use my imagination. It's there for me to be had. So
I love that.
I just think it's applicable in so many circumstances.
It's great. That's great. And it's great that they're doing that work. That's so... Yeah. Cool. And I wonder what sparked that for them. I always have to imagine it was somebody's personal experience with Alzheimer's. It was somebody's, you know, somebody that they loved and they saw that that person's brain was changing and it inspired them to make a program like that.
I think it could be. I mean, I think so many of us who work in the arts, like, from the most visible jobs like performing to the high profile jobs like producing, but also jobs like selling tickets or running a gallery or being an usher, like all of the people who have a background in the arts, I think can articulate the many ways in which having that background helps them in their daily lives.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, I've spoken to a million people who don't work in the arts, but perhaps they took an improv class in college, or they took a public speaking class, or, you know, they took an art class, and they still recognize how much it benefits them to have had that experience that they can draw from.
Yeah.
Because I do think it transforms your mind.
Yeah,
I do. I agree. In this case, for this group, the memory ensemble, so they tried to assess and track changes to their mood and behavior, you know, before and after class.
Oh,
and
yeah.
One of the key learnings, one participant of the group said, I'm not sure that my memory has objectively improved, but I am sure that my ability to cope with my memory loss has improved.
That is great.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that amazing?
It is great. And as somebody, as I age, I know that something, and I joke about it, but I joke about my early onset Alzheimer's and dementia, but I feel like there are things like this, mantras like the one that you just shared with us, and even practices that I've tried to implement in order to ease some of that, whether it's memory loss or my anxiety around it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so things like meditating and, mantras like the one you just shared. I think that's so cool.
I mean, just having ways in which to cope with those realities of life.
Yeah.
I did continue to gather some evidence because I kept feeling like if we're going to go on science, let's go all in on science. Then, you know, we have gut feelings,
let's go all
and of
in,
course
baby.
We know, right? But let's. So I dug into an article in Medical News Today, and of course, they had me at the beginning because they reminded me, like, we've been creating. Human beings have been creating since prehistoric times, literally more than, you know, almost 40,000 years ago. Our ancestors left some of their first marks, those cave paintings, the outlines of their hands and drawings of animals, some that, you know, with the use of the fire animated on the walls of caves. And God, when you think about that, I'm like, yes, we were meant to be creative beings. We are all capable of creativity. In this comprehensive article on the connection between art, healing, and public health, Heather L. Stuckey and Jeremy Noble say that art helps people express experiences that are too difficult to put into words. That reminded me of the quote from Nietzsche that says, we have art in order to not die of the truth.
Oh.
And that, then I was like, oh, I forgot about that. And that is like that, that's what hit me in terms of the year 2020. The truth around us, the very painful things happening around us, we have art in order to not die of the truth.
Oh my God. I don't know that I've ever heard that. Wow.
I had heard it and I was like, wow, I put that away somewhere. So art is how we cope with difficult truths. And if that's so, then we need art now more than ever in a very real and very vital way. Science has also proved that engaging in the fine arts can lead to the improved mental health we talked about, including maintenance and reconstruction of a positive identity, a boost in our immune system, which frankly, I think we would all welcome right about now.
Yes.
Increased feelings of happiness and joy from the elevated dopamine levels, improved cognitive function. It assists in overcoming trauma and negative emotions. And of course, there's physical benefits from dance and movement. Alice Walker said, hard times require furious dancing. And that just gets me like, I've been feeling that all year. And that was a great reminder that we absolutely need to be moving our bodies and, you know, in order to cope with everything we've been asked to cope with this year.
Yeah.
And lastly, I want to say this. I also read about a therapist named Natalie Rogers, who's the daughter of Carl Rogers.
No kidding.
That's right. That's right. Theory of Creativity. She wrote this article called Giving Life to Carl Rogers, Theory of Creativity. And in it, she said this: in these times where conformity is being thrust upon us by governments, we urgently need strong individuals who are able to think and act creatively. Creativity threatens those who demand conformity. Dictators squelch self-expression and the creative process. They do not want their citizens to think for themselves or to be spontaneous, imaginative, or self-determined. Thus, creativity is subversive to those who demand conformity to a political system. I believe that to maintain and foster democracy in our world, we must be creative. That is, to be able to play with ideas, see alternative solutions, and be able to listen empathetically to all sides. With that, I was reminded of the relevancy, the urgency even, of creativity and the very, very real need for each of us to express acts of creativity every day. Every day. So let me just say, when I consider what to make of it, I genuinely think everything by engaging in creative acts, large or small, perhaps trying out a new flavor of jam on your muffin in the morning, or getting yourself a coloring book or a 10-foot canvas and just going for it, or maybe journaling each day, rearranging the furniture in your bedroom, or freestyle dancing in the driveway. It's all creative. And if you're blocked by the big ideas, maybe set those aside for now. Like, you don't have to be writing a novel right now. You don't have to paint a masterpiece right now. Maybe bring down your expectations if they're getting in your way. Be kind to yourself. Perhaps just go spark harvesting and put those ideas in your spark file for when you have more energy and more capacity. And how about celebrating every spark of creativity you do find? Every single act of creativity benefits you personally and may also benefit others. It might even serve as a subversive act against conformity and help us rebuild a culture that is inclusive of diverse ideas and perspectives. That's where I'm feeling right now.
Camion.
I don't know if I told you.
That is like a mega spark.
Well, it was a lot. It was a lot to fit into this, but it really restored my faith. I was like, yes, 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 yes. I can put that little streak of doubt that had crept up. I can set that aside and not give it any of my attention or time.
Yeah.
And I was happy. I was happy for that. I mean, of course, like, I know these things and you know these things, but I needed a little refresher. I needed a reminder and to be grounded in not just what I suspected to be true, but is in fact provable and true. Just period. True.
And you got the science to back it up, baby.
I have the science to back it up. I don't know if I told you this, but Tim, my friend Tim, has said that he's been using this time to rethink and reconsider what he wants to do with his remaining time on Earth.
Yes.
And he's exploring potentially going back to school to study drama therapy. And I have to say, especially after being reminded of the healing power of creativity, I can think of no better way to serve others than to spread the word and to use our artistic talents to help others and help ourselves heal.
I think it's great. And, you know, it's so funny. It sort of answers a question that I've been sitting with ever since that coaching client was sort of like, is this all? I mean, the world has so many more pressing needs. Creativity feels indulgent right now. And what I couldn't fully articulate, which you just did so beautifully with that spark, is say, that's how we're going to rise up out of this time through all different acts of creativity and even how we're going to heal.
So we heal ourselves, we heal each other.
Yeah. What a great flipping spark. Holy moly.
And we're back.
Way to bring it back, Cammie.
Fuck around and find out. Fuck around and find out. You think I can't ride a spark? Fuck around and find out.
I never said you couldn't ride a spark.
I know. I was joking. I was just trying to put it in context.
That's amazing. Should we take a little breaky poo and then I'll try to spark you back?
Okay great.
Let's do it. Camion, may I interest you in a second helping of spark?
I would like a big old helping of sparks, please.
Well, all right. I've got one for you. And I want to say that there's, here are some sources for this spark, a Time Magazine article by Eric Barker, an article on PBS.org, a book by Stephen Southwick and Dennis Charney called Resilience, the Science of Mastering Life's Greatest Challenges. Cams, I will tell you, I'm just going to lay it bare right at the top. I wanted to do a spark about resilience. I've been thinking in the same way that you were like, I need to go looking for this spark about why creativity and why now. I have been thinking a lot about resilience during this time and noticing in myself and in others a sense of resilience or what seemed to be a testing of my resilience slash other people's resilience.
Hell yeah.
And I've noticed, and we've talked about this, how some people seem to really, really be struggling, just like stuck in struggle. And some folks seem to be really called to action during this time and seem to be like much more in the flow with that call to action. And I have felt both ways. I have felt there are times when I have felt very like, just sort of like, I am going to, you know, use this, not even in spite of this pandemic, but I was like, if this is where we're at right now, what can we do now that we have never done before?
Mm-hmm.
Like the really, really keyed into that and really, like in the flow in a good way. And then there have been times, Cams, and you have witnessed this, where I have hit a wall and then climbed onto the struggle bus and just like took a nice long ride on the struggle bus.
Yeah.
And the driver kept looking back and saying, is this your stop? And I'd say, no, I'm going to ride on this some more. So
take me back around. But Suze, I want to add to that. The other day I literally jotted this down like, wow, there are moments where I have like shock and awe. I have surprised myself with my own ability to survive, like my own survival skills and resilience, which is what I think you're talking about. And then other days / weeks where I'm like, I just feel shaken and completely off. And if you ask me what I want to do, I want nothing other than to curl up in a ball and be like, I don't feel like being resilient right now. I don't want to.
Yeah. And for anybody listening, I think that's pretty natural. And I think it's super natural right now. Mm-hmm. But in observing myself and you and other loved ones in our lives who have sort of been doing this dance, this furious dance, I was really curious if resilience was something that could be actively cultivated. And so I looked in a lot of places, and I don't know if you saw it, but I asked on Instagram what resources people could recommend on the topic of resilience. And I got a lot of really, really good responses. And I dove into them. Like, I listened to Brené Brown's podcast. Yeah. And specifically, there was one with a guest named David Kessler, who I think you may have referenced in a past spark, who's like a grief expert. The book Option B by Sheryl Sandberg and Adam Grant. Eva Price, who's a Broadway producer who we know and love. Hi, Eva. Eva Price gave a TED Talk about having and recovering from brain surgery. There's a woman named Lizzie Velasquez who has a series of really, really excellent talks and TED Talks. People recommended the book Wave about a woman who lost her husband and two children in the 2004 tsunami. Also the book Once More We Saw Stars by Jason Green, which is a memoir about how he and his wife coped when their toddler was killed in a tragic accident. And I took a deep dive into these resources. And I have to say, they were great. But for the most part, they're anecdotal. And I appreciated them so much. But I was like, okay, how can we be more resilient? I know that you're saying that we should, but how? Mm-hmm. And there were little pieces of wisdom, and big pieces of wisdom in those things about how we could be more resilient. But I was still left with this question of what factors, specific factors, contribute to a person's resilience.
Oh my God, I hope you're going to tell us, because I think educators have been grappling with this for a long time. There's that book Grit, and this idea of like, how do you teach children to have it?
Yeah.
If you can define it, and then how do you help them have it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. So yes and yes. So in the midst of all of this, the weirdest coincidence occurred. So I'm literally hands on the keyboard in the middle of putting this spark together and struggling with it, honestly, because I was like, okay, I have all of these stories and anecdotes about people who demonstrated resilience, but I don't know what to say about it. And then I get an email from a client asking if I'm available to lead a creativity workshop with their group. So I'm speaking to the client, and next to them on the Zoom is one of their closest friends. And I'm asking the close friend about what she does. And I ask her what she's making. And she says one of her projects, which is temporarily on pause because of the pandemic, is on resilience.
Oh, and my gosh.
I go, did you say Brazilians? And she goes, no, resilience. And I was like, I literally paused my work on this spark to take this call. And here is this person. So the figure at the center of this documentary that she is making is this dude named Dr. Stephen Southwick. He is an MD from Yale. And according to this wonderful woman / spark bearer that I've just met, Stephen Southwick is an authority on resilience. He has literally written the book on resilience for clinicians, but this documentarian wants to make this film on resilience featuring Dr. Stephen Southwick so that normal everyday people like you and me can understand it and benefit from it. Mm. So I look up Dr. Stephen, I get off the phone and I immediately look up Dr. Stephen Southwick, and oh my God, Camion, I hit the spark jackpot.
The mother load.
I've never had something exactly like that happen. It was so crazy. So
that's incredible.
It was amazing. So I just want to shout out Linda, who was the spark bearer for this. I cannot thank you enough. So with Dr. Dennis Charney, Stephen Southwick wrote a book called Resilience, The Science of Mastering Life's Greatest Challenges. And I was like, this is exactly what I've been looking for. This is the research behind resilience. I've been poking around all over the place. I'm not finding exactly what I want. This woman, this beautiful woman out of the blue, hands it to me, which is a side spark, which is sparks will come to you if you're present for them. So back
true.
To resilience. So true. So to your questions, Camion, what is it? How do we define it? And in their book, Dennis Charney and Stephen Southwick write, in the physical sciences, materials and objects are termed resilient if they resume their original shape upon being bent or stretched. In people, resilience refers to the ability to bounce back after encountering difficulty. And they go on to say, in his book, Aging Well, Harvard University psychologist George Vaillant, hope I'm pronouncing that right, describes resilient individuals as resembling a twig with a fresh green living core. When twisted out of shape, such a twig bends, but it does not break. Instead, it springs back and continues growing. So there's a little bit of a definition of resilience for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So yeah.
I
just want to explore just for a second, because my mind went to like that idea of like something going back to its original shape. But but in humans, I think of resilience as, yes, bending but not breaking, then returning but in an altered / improved state. Do they talk about that, or is that just what's going on in my mind?
Yeah, they do talk about that. They do talk about that. And it's actually that, what we can say that, I don't know if you want to call it positive change or evolution that occurs, or alchemy, or whatever you want to call it, I think is one of the hallmarks of resilience that somebody can metabolize like a challenging situation mm-hmm. and, you know, maybe even improve because of it. But mm-hmm. I'll use their words because I feel like I'll just botch it. So, but yes, we're going to get to that. So,
okay, great.
They say in this book, they say that traumatic events throw our lives into turmoil in unpredictable ways, and no two people will respond to them in exactly the same manner. For some, the stress of an event will become chronic and last for years, mm-hmm. and the individual may undergo a dramatic change in outlook. They may become sullen, demoralized, withdrawn, cynical, and angry. And I think we all have observed people like that. Maybe we've observed a taste of that in ourselves as well. Some people will become depressed or develop PTSD. Horrific, intrusive memories and nightmares will haunt them for days, months, even years, and they will feel unsafe in the world, hypervigilant, as if another serious danger lurks just around the corner. I have experienced that for sure, for sure, for sure. Some will take up drinking or drugs to numb their pain and dull their memories. Nevertheless, many people will find ways to meet the challenge and continue with purposeful lives. For a period after their ordeal, they may become distressed, but in time, they will bounce back and carry on. For some, it will be almost as if the trauma had never occurred. For others, the distress will persist, but they will find healthy ways to cope. Here you go, Camian. Some survivors will even grow stronger and wiser because of their trauma. These survivors may report that their tragedy has helped them to appreciate life more, to become closer to family and friends, to find greater meaning, and sometimes to embark on a new mission in life. In the words of Elizabeth S. Lucas, a protege of Viktor Frankl, the forces of fate that bear down on man and threaten to break him also have the capacity to ennoble him. And I think that's what you're talking about, Camian, which is not only does the twig not break, it is transformed or it evolves or it is ennobled in some way. Mm-hmm. So all of that is to say there are lots of different ways that people respond to challenge and traumatic events. And I know that in that description, with the exception of I never took up like drinking or drugs to numb my pain, but I've taken up other things to numb my pain. But I feel like I've dabbled in all of that all of the aforementioned myself. Sure. So I was like, I read all that and I was like, I want to be in the group that grows as a result of a challenge and even as a result of trauma. And I really do believe that if you have to live through it, surely there must be a way for it to ultimately have a positive impact. But I've always thought in order to get there, you have to be willing to remain present to the present while at the same time, keep moving, not getting stuck, and eventually like one foot in front of the other, marching through the challenge or the trauma. And in that way, you can eventually draw from the experience and decide what meaning you're going to derive from it, what lessons you're going to take away from it. So that's where my mind has been, but I'm not a Yale or a Harvard doctor who studied this. So I was just curious what these fellas had to say about it. So, I mean, no doubt 2020 has been fraught with challenge and trauma for many people. And I wanted to know specifically in response to this time, even how to bolster my resilience, because I do want to move through this time with grace while also remaining present to it, because this is going to be our life for, you know, the foreseeable future.
For the foreseeable future.
Yeah. So, and I've made a habit in my life. I don't want to wish it away. I don't want to say, oh, I can't wait till this is over. Oh, yeah. I can't wait till I've really tried to catch myself with that because time is precious and fleeting, and I don't want to wish it away. So I dug into this work of Dr. Stephen Southwick and Dennis Charney to see what I could learn about how to bolster my own resilience and hopefully you, Cams, your resilience, and you little sparklers, your resiliences. So these fellas interviewed a lot of different kinds of people to learn about resilience, and a lot of people that really do work that puts them, I would say, really in toe-to-toe with like trauma and challenge. So these are prisoners of war, folks in special forces, people who have encountered high levels of stress and then demonstrated resilience. And then they analyzed these interviews and they identified 10 resilience factors that prove to be effective for dealing with stress and trauma. More about that in just a moment. I just want to make an acknowledgement that we have talked about, we talk about it sometimes in our workshops. We've talked about it in different contexts, but I just want to say this again. They write about this so beautifully in their book. The playing field is not level when it comes to resilience. Individuals who are, for instance, unable to think clearly, regulate their moods, they would have trouble implementing the advice of this work in their lives. Because, for instance, if you're experiencing a major depression or you've suffered a traumatic brain injury, that path to bouncing back may be steeper. Mm-hmm. And then there are folks who have more resources, such as financial security, a higher level of education, an interesting and rewarding career, strong social networks. People that have any of the aforementioned are able to leverage those resources, and people who lack those resources may fall into what they call a loss spiral. So they give the example of a family that loses its home to a hurricane. And one family may have literally nowhere else to live. Another family may have the option of moving in with relatives. Another family may be fortunate enough to have a second home. So you can see how, if you're the family that literally has nowhere else to go, mm-hmm. like you hope to find space in a shelter, you can see how that is a steeper path back. Oh, that resilience is not going to be as easy.
Yep.
So,
just feeling the sense of like dominoes falling and
exactly
the consequence of one thing on the next. Yeah.
Absolutely. I want to read what they say in their book because I think it's worth reading. When we advocate for resilience, we believe that most of us can choose to fight back after a trauma and attempt to right ourselves. However, we must emphasize that some people lack access to support and resources that make it easier or even possible to do so. This does not mean that those with scarce resources should give up, but rather recognizes that they will have a more difficult road to travel. Understanding these limitations may allow us to be more patient with ourselves or with others who are striving to recover from trauma. And I want to add to this, it may make us more empathetic and more inclined to be of support to others to help them bolster their resilience during a time like the one we're living through now. I feel like that's a spark. Like if you want to like study resilience for your own benefit, rock the fuck on. But also, I think it's worthy to study it to understand that playing field isn't level, and you might come up with a really great creative way to be of support to somebody who doesn't have the resources that you do, so that you can help people bolster their own resilience and get back up on their feet, especially during a time like this.
Suze, I feel the need to like confess a little bit, because I recognize in my younger self, I've had the ability to be resilient, and it could be as small as like, you know, working when sick, or, you know, just suffering through it, getting through it, digging deep and making it happen anyway. And I feel like in reflecting back, I feel like I had little patience with other people who couldn't do the same thing, whatever the things were that happened that I was able to do. Like, why couldn't other people do that too?
Yeah.
And of course, in my wise old age, I definitely along the way learned what they're talking about. It's like, not everyone has the same skills, skill set or beginning circumstances to work with. And then, and you don't know. You don't know what they're going through.
And you don't know.
And you don't know. You'll never be able to know. And then, frankly, it's only after, you know, I've had periods of time where I struggled with things and I was like, oh, man, I should have been a little bit more patient with people when they were struggling with things. So I'm much wiser now. But I just want to say, now I have it sorted. But I just feel like we don't know.
I want to add to that, which when you're, let's say your resilient tank has been drained, your what Emily Fletcher would call your adaptation energy has been drained
yes.
by challenges that you are facing, I think it's even more, it takes even more effort to have that empathy mm-hmm. and remember the playing field is uneven. You don't know what other people are going through.
100%.
Yeah.
We have no idea. And this year has illustrated that to the millionth degree. That just that idea of like, we're all in the same storm. We are not in the same boat.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Mm. Cams, I'm so excited to share some of these resilience factors with you and all of you sparklers. And I would actually, as we talk and as you listen, sparklers, I would love to hear how you all may have already implemented some of these in your own lives or how you want to implement them. So make sure you hit us up. What did the kids say? Hit us up on social. Tag us. There's an article by Eric Barker in Time Magazine. And I got to say, Eric Barker did me a solid because Eric Barker distilled down some of these findings from the book Resilience into his article. So thanks, Eric. You're a peach. The first, and these are not necessarily, I don't think these are in order of importance, but I've heard Dr. Stephen Southwick talk a little bit and he has underscored what he thinks is the first place to look. So when I run into that one, I'll let you know. So number one, be optimistic. So we're talking about looking on the bright side, yes, and that's going to keep us going, yes, but we're not talking about delusional sort of Pollyanna style rose-colored glasses here. Truly resilient people who need to survive the harshest situations and still accomplish goals balance a positive outlook with a realistic view of the world. So this is actually from the book Resilience, The Science of Mastering Life's Greatest Challenges by Dennis Charney and Dr. Stephen Southwick. And they say this, like pessimists, realistic optimists pay close attention to negative information that is relevant to the problems they face. However, unlike pessimists, they do not remain focused on the negative. Mm-hmm. They tend to disengage rapidly from problems that appear to be unsolvable. That is, they know when to cut their losses and turn their attention to problems that they believe they can solve. So in an interview I watched with Dennis Charney, who again, co-authored the book, he talked about something called the Stockdale Paradox. It's named after Jim Stockdale, a heroic prisoner of war. And it defines the optimism that is most important in becoming a resilient person. So you might look at a challenge or trauma and say objectively and realistically, I'm in really big trouble. And on the other hand, you have the attitude and the confidence to say, but I will prevail. Mm-hmm. So I'm in a tough spot, but I will prevail. And that sort of balance, and we're going to look at it again in the next facet of resilience, but that sort of balance of this is tough or this hurts, but I'm going to be okay, or this sucks, but I will prevail is kind of where that seems like the sweet spot in terms of resilience.
That it's so important to make that that specification, because so many people think optimism is like Pollyanna and falsehood, like you're just pretending like everything's okay. When in actuality, you can be a true optimist by looking at something and saying, this is not okay, and I am capable of fixing it, and I can overcome this, and I can achieve this, you know?
Yes.
Both things can be true. Optimism can hold those multitudes.
Yeah. They cite a really nice passage from Helen Keller, who, I trust everybody knows who Helen Keller is, but they said in the book how Helen Keller saw adversity as a prerequisite for real optimism. And it's that thing where, you know, this is from her writing. A man must understand evil and be acquainted with sorrow before he can write himself an optimist and expect others to believe that he has reason for the faith that is in him.
Oh.
And I think that's I do think it makes it credible if you're sort of like, I view myself as this kind of person, frankly, where it's like, I've been through some shit. I have been through some shit. And I still, for the most part, remain pretty positive and pretty optimistic.
Yes.
And I feel like it lends credibility to that optimism. And it isn't just sort of like Pollyanna pie in the sky because I've been through some shit. So I dug that. Okay. So moving on. Facing your fears. So neuroscience says there's only one real way to deal with fear. You need to face it head on. And that is what most resilient people do. When we avoid scary things, we become more scared. When you face your fears, they become less frightening. What do special forces soldiers think when facing the most terrifying situations? This actually relates to number one. They think things like this: I'm scared, but I can learn from this. Or this is a test that's going to make me stronger. So this actually reminded me, Camian, of this. I don't know. Did I ever tell you the story about how, I'm going to say about 2.5 years ago, I wanted to get some furniture, some big pieces of furniture for our house. And, you know, this is normally something that I would be like, Nathan, help me, but he was unavailable. And so, but I really wanted to do this and it was time sensitive. So I rented a U-Haul truck by myself and I drove some pretty like windy, windy, mountainy, treacherous roads.
What?
To about an hour there, loaded the truck and drove it an hour home by myself. And I was really viscerally scared. I was really, really scared. And I wasn't used to driving a truck that big or being up that high or not being able to see out of the sort of rear view mirror that's on the windshield. Mm-hmm. And so it was all like, I could feel the wind blowing the truck. And I said to myself, I accidentally stumbled onto this, a mantra like this, where I was like, I'm scared, but I can do this. And I was literally saying out loud to myself in the cab of the truck, you've got this. You've got this. This is scary, but you have got this, Susan.
You've got this.
And I will tell you, when I got home and pulled that truck into the fucking driveway and pulled up the thing, we unloaded the furniture, I felt like I could do anything. I felt like I had really like faced a fear and slayed a dragon. So I related to that.
So incredible. That is so incredible. It's reminding me of my brother when he was raising and still is raising, but my niece Bailey, when she was like 3 years old, she was terrified of Santa Claus.
I've never heard of that.
He talked to her about like, and my stepmom like collected Santa Clauses. So there were a lot of around the
Santa
house.
Phobia.
Yes.
Oh my God.
And
oh my God.
One day I came upon her. She was like behind a couch where like Santa was right near it. And I came upon her doing this very self-talk. She was saying, it's okay. I'm okay. I'm okay. It's okay. And then, I watched her as she then like got up and like faced that Santa Claus that was just around the other side of the couch. And I talked to my brother about it and I was like, Scotty, that what I just witnessed was amazing. And he's like, yeah, we've been working on that.
Amazing.
You know, really talking, saying to yourself, it's okay. I'm scared, but I'm okay. And Suze, look at you, just like you employed that as you're driving through these treacherous mountains.
I'm really experimenting with this in real time, Cams, where I'm trying to disrupt negative, consciously disrupt negative thoughts and reframe them. And I've been, because I have felt the need to do it lately, I have been really practicing it. And there are some that are more deeply rooted and it takes it's going to be rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat, rinse, repeat.
Yeah.
But I'm working on it. So I like having things like that in my little toolkit and like the mantra that you just shared with us in your spark. I like having that in my toolkit.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. So let's jump back in. Number three, this one actually was so surprising to me. Have a moral compass. The emotionally resilient people that Southwick and Charney studied all had a strong sense of right and wrong. Despite being in situations that could threaten their lives, they always thought about others, not just themselves. So it's a strong moral compass, strong right and wrong, but also a strong awareness, it sounds like, of other people's well-being. And this is from their book. In our interviews, we found that many resilient individuals possessed a keen sense of right and wrong that strengthened them during periods of extreme stress and afterward as they adjusted to life following trauma. Also, altruism, selflessness, concern for the welfare of others, and giving to others with no expectation of benefit to the self often stood as a pillar of their value system, of their moral compass. And I read that and I was like, check, I've got it. I've got a strong moral compass. If you're listening to this and you don't, there's something to work on. Work on that moral compass.
Wow.
If you're a sociopath, work on it.
Yeah.
I think you have a strong moral compass too. I'm going to give you a check too on that.
Thanks.
One.
Thanks. Thank you. Check. I feel like I check, do. Check, check. Yeah. Yeah. It is one of those though that makes me wonder, like that second question of like, if you don't have one, where do you get one?
That's a different spark for, that's another
spark, another spark for another day. Okay.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
I'm setting it aside.
Here we go. This one is actually, this is something that I find very interesting and is actually something one could work on. So it is number four, practice spirituality. This was the number one thing that one researcher found when studying people who overcame tragedy. In the book Resilience, the authors cite the work of Dr. Ahmad, who found religious belief among survivors to be the single most powerful force in explaining the tragedy and in explaining survival. But Camion, what if you're not religious? Let us peel back a layer. Because if I'm not interested in engaging in like organized religion, but they didn't say religion, they said practice spirituality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So much of the strength from religious activity comes from being part of a community. So you don't have to do anything you don't believe in, but you want to be part of a group that strengthens your resolve. So this is from their book again. The word religion comes from the Latin term religare. I don't know how to pronounce it, meaning to bind. People who regularly attend religious services may have access to a deeper and broader form of social support than is often available in a secular setting. So this is what, this actually goes back to all the sparks that, or not all the sparks, but this actually goes back to some of the sparks from The Art of Dying Well, which is, and it's something I think about all the time. And it's the one thing that when I just clicked on like a 1 minute video with Dr. Stephen Southwick, and he was like, when people ask me about resilience, the first thing that I want to ask them is, do you have a community of people that you could reliably reach out to and really like that they would be there to support you, that you could share your real feelings with them, that you could really talk with them. And if you don't have that, that I would think is the first thing that you want to develop in order to bolster and strengthen your resilience. So I offer you that.
Wow.
If it's something you need to tend to. And frankly, I think about that. I'm like, I want to make sure that as an introvert, sometimes I can just put my head straight up my ass, but I want to make sure that I really make a beautiful investment in those relationships because not only is it's good for all of us in so many ways, meaningful engagement, it's so good for us, but it also seems that it really supports resilience. So there you go.
Wow. That is so, yet another thing it supports.
There you go. And great. It actually feeds into number five, which is get social support. So if you're not part of a religion or a community, friends and loved ones are key when life gets hard, but we can't always be surrounded by others, especially in a pandemic, Camion.
Mm-hmm.
But how can people we love and respect help us thrive? And how can we help those that we love and respect to thrive when we are separated? And so they gave me, and I give you, a story that I heard about some time ago, but they reminded me of it. Do you know the story about the tap code, Camion?
No.
Have you ever heard? It's a great spark. It is a standalone spark. It is okay. Beautiful, but I'm going to bust it out now.
Okay.
So in June of 1965, four prisoners of war, their names were Captain Carlisle Smitty Harris, Lieutenant Philip Butler, Lieutenant Robert Peel, and Lieutenant Commander Robert Schumacher, who were imprisoned in the same cell in the Hanoi Hilton, they devised a simple secretive tap code. These four men, expecting to be split up again, vowed to continue their resistance. And to do so, they knew that communicating closely would be essential. So they developed this tap code by tapping on the walls of their cells so that the fellow prisoners could hear it and they would be able to respond without the guards knowing.
Wow.
And it was a code. It's this simple, like five across, five down code that indicate letters so you can quickly spell out, you can quickly spell out words. And this tap code let them know that they were not alone in their suffering.
Oh my gosh.
And it provided this critical lifeline mm-hmm. that allowed scores of prisoners to connect with one another, because slowly over time, they taught this tap code to other imprisoned men in this prisoner of war camp. And they said, if they hadn't had the tap code, they wouldn't have remained sane. And they developed friendships for life via that tap code. Friendships with people whose faces they didn't even see for years.
That's incredible.
It's amazing.
Incredible.
And I have to tell you, these were people, trigger warning, these were people that were tortured mercilessly. Like, these were people that were isolated and tortured, and they demonstrated such resilience. They came out on the other side because they were bonded through this tap code. So prisoner of war Vice Admiral James Stockdale wrote a book with his wife Sybil called In Love and War. And he said, our tapping ceased to be just an exchange of letters and words. It became conversations, elation, sadness, humor, sarcasm, excitement, depression. It all came through. Some of the acronyms entered POW popular usage. One acronym, GBU, was used as a universal sign-off, and it was shorthand for God bless you.
Oh.
So I want to say this to you, like, and anybody who's listening who is Zoom fatigued, if these men can survive this isolation and this torture with this tap code, we can survive and we can have true connection and really meaningful connection with others via this beautiful technology that we have.
That's correct.
And yes, and that connection releases oxytocin, which calms our minds and reduces stress. And so find your tap code. Find your tap code. Yeah. Which takes us to number six. Oh, have resilient role models. So when you study kids who grow up in impoverished circumstances but go on to live productive, healthy lives, what did they find? They had great role models who provided positive examples and supported them. So it could be this is actually in the book. One of the first psychologists to study resilience was a person named Emmy Werner. And Emmy followed the lives of children who were raised in impoverished homes with alcoholic, abusive, or mentally ill parent or parents. And Werner observed that resilient children who grew up to be productive and emotionally healthy adults had at least one person in their lives who truly supported them and served as an admired role model. And the research of the gentleman who wrote Resilience found similar patterns. All of the resilient individuals they interviewed had role models whose beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors inspired them. But also, it also seems to work if you find what they refer to as sort of like negative role models. So you could also identify people who you don't want to emulate, who you don't admire, and you can sort of do the opposite. So it, you know, you could have kind of a tough parent, but you could be like, I'm actually going to do the opposite of that. I'm going to be If that's they're violent, right. I'm going to be peaceful. If they're, you know what I mean?
It's like learning what not to do. I learned a lot from that person. Mostly what not to do or what not, how not to be. Yeah.
Negative role models, baby.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Camion, you're going to love number seven. Number seven coming at you. Maintain physical fitness.
Woo! Camion. Yes.
Yes. So again and again, the authors of Resilience saw that the most resilient people had good exercise habits and kept their bodies as well as their minds strong. And this is what they say in their book. Many of the resilient individuals we interviewed have a regular habit of exercise and believe that staying fit has helped them both during their traumatic ordeals and during their recovery. In fact, some of them credit physical exercise with saving their lives. They say that it seems like the stress of exercise helps us adapt to the stress that we will feel when life challenges us. And that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And research bears out that, like, you know, when you're at CAMS, you know, when you're exercising and you're like, oh, I don't want to do this or this hurts or this sucks. But then you do it because you know it's good for you. You do it because you know you can get through it. And I think it's a good, it tells the brain and tells the body, you actually can endure.
Yes, you can.
Like rigorous, challenging circumstances. Yes.
100%. 100%.
I have to say, I think you and I both implemented an exercise routine during the pandemic.
We did. It was a necessity.
Yeah. And it's really helped.
Yeah. It's been literally life-saving for me. Life-changing, life-saving. And I would say as much on the mental level as on the physical level.
Well, Camion, that leads to number eight, which is keep your brain strong.
What?
Keep your brain strong, Camion. So it turns out that resilient people are often lifelong learners.
Mm.
They keep growing their mind. They are learning to learn and adapting to new information about the world. And I have to say, this rocks my world because I love that we do the SparkFall podcast because I feel like we continually learn. And I think listeners, we count you in that as well. I hope that one of the benefits of listening to this podcast is that you are like growing your brain and, you know, keeping it spongy, keep it spongy.
that's a phrase that's going to take off, I think.
Keep it spongy. But I also think like it makes me happy that we have things that are built into our lives, like this podcast.
It's baked in.
I love that. And also during this pandemic, I have learned so much new technology during this pandemic.
Yeah.
Shit that I'm just like, I cannot believe I know how to do that now.
Yep.
And I think that's part of it too. So I know sometimes people are resistant to it because they're like, I never wanted to become an expert at Zoom. And I'm like, how about you put an exclamation mark at the end of that sentence? Because it's just like, it's so good for us. It's so good for our brains and it's so good for our resilience.
It is.
And it leads to number nine, which is be cognitively flexible. People who are resilient tend to be flexible in the way we think about challenges, flexible in the way we react emotionally to stress. They say these types of people are not wedded to a specific style of coping. Instead, they shift from one coping strategy to another, depending on the circumstances.
Mm.
So in his Time magazine article, Eric Barker says, "What's a good coping style that definitely works? I've spoken to a number of elite military operators, and I've learned the same thing over and over. Be tough? Nope. Ignore it? Nope. They all mentioned, can you guess, Camion?
Flexibility. Yeah?
Humor.
No. Humor. Oh, I thought we were on
humor.
Wow.
It's part of being cognitively flexible.
Yeah, you got to laugh about it. You got to laugh and keep going. Yeah.
You have got to laugh.
Oh.
Fuck with me and find out, Camion. You have got to laugh. You've got to laugh. I love that. Okay. So here is the last one.
That's so good.
The last one, these aren't necessarily in order, but the last one on this list that the beautiful Eric Barker pulled together for me. Thanks, Eric, is find meaning in what you do. Resilient people don't have jobs. They have callings. They have a mission and purpose in life that gives meaning to the things that they do. So when times are hard, these folks feel a greater purpose is behind them, pushing them forward. So this is from their book, Resilience. In keeping with Viktor Frankl's conception of service as a pillar of meaning, the ability to see one's work as a calling may enhance resilience. This holds true even for people performing dirty work jobs. For example, hospital cleaners, which I'm sure this was written before the pandemic, wow. But yes.
Yeah.
And for people who have been prevented from pursuing their chosen career. I'm going to say that again. This holds true even for people performing dirty jobs and for people who have been prevented from pursuing their chosen career. So I think that if you're sort of like, wait a second, I'm not doing work that I find meaning, does that mean I can't be a resilient person? I would say do some research, do some digging about finding your purpose. And if you don't know what it is, I really recommend looking at Simon Sinek's TED Talk, Start with Why, because I watched that thing, I'm going to say 7 to 10 times, and my purpose really did like rise to the surface for me.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to be doing your dream job in order to say with certainty that you're doing purposeful work. You can do some research to find that.
That's right. And you can also be purposeful and meaningful in how you show up at that job. You know, even if you're not finding meaning in the work.
That's right.
It's in the relationships and how you do the work. That I think can be really purposeful and meaningful. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. Whether your job is like cleaning floors or making fudge, whatever it is, like you really can set intentions around that work that make it meaningful and infuse it with purpose.
Yeah.
So Camion, that was I encourage, if you have any interest in bolstering and strengthening your own resilience, I cannot recommend this book highly enough, Resilience by Dennis Charney and Stephen Southwick. But what do we make of it? What can we take away from this to increase our resilience during this batshit crazy time that we're living in and beyond? Just a little recap. See the world clearly, but believe in your abilities. Develop and implement mantras like, this is scary, but I got this.
Mm-hmm.
Know that hiding from fear makes it worse. Pick something that scares you. Face it. Maybe even overcome it. Mm-hmm. Develop a strong moral compass, a strong sense of right and wrong. Extend that altruism to others. Practice spirituality. Be a part of a group that has strong beliefs. Develop a network of friends that you can really communicate with. Develop your own tap code with a group of people that you can rely on so that you can give and receive social support. And I'm telling you, this could be over Marco Polo. This could be over Voxer. This could be over Zoom. Tap on the wall of your cell. Send messages that can keep you going and keep your friends going. Identify and imitate resilient role models. These could be people in your life, or read about people like Helen Keller and Viktor Frankl, or identify people that you know you do not want to be like and do opposite day. Exercise your body, exercise your brain by being a lifelong learner. Keep your brain sharp, and it will give you solutions when you need them most. Be like Navy SEALs and Special Forces operators and laugh and laugh and laugh. And be sure to have meaning in your life. And don't just do a job. Have a calling. Have a purpose. And if you don't know your purpose, why don't you do a little research and start seeking that purpose? Any of these speaking to you, Cam? Are there any of these that you're like, I think I'm gonna take this and I'm going to either try it out freshly, or I'm going to double down on it when I don't want to go for that walk and I don't want to exercise?
I'm definitely going to double down on so much of it. Yes, the physical and the mental. I like that. I really like the tapping on the wall of your own cell, because, you know, I can really get the blinders on in terms of like, I have work to do. In a like productivity haze, and I have to stop and respond to people who've reached out to me, and I have to do my own reaching out, and I feel like I'm not great at that. And it's inexcusable. It's not good. I really think it would be so beneficial and meaningful to be better at that.
Yeah.
And improve my resiliency.
Yeah. I think about that all the time. Yeah. And I struggle with it because I am, you know, we're busy. We got a lot going on and I'm an introvert and it's so easy to just not to send the tap out, but I'm going to keep pushing myself to do that.
Tap. Yeah, it does make me think all the time about that spark that you did, The Art of Dying Well. And the idea of having that community, maybe someday, literally a physical community wherein, loved ones and friends live in a commune.
Amen.
Living in community with each other.
Exchanging Marco Polos with Stephen Pasquale and Pippa Sue.
Aww.
And we were like, where's it going to be? Where's it going to be? Yeah. I am actively thinking about where it's going to be so that when I literally tap on the wall, you're going to be like, cut it out. Keep it down over there. Quiet down, Susan. Quiet. When I yell, I've fallen and I can't get up. I don't need life alert. I've got you, Camion. You're going to come lift me up.
I'll be there and I will be able to lift you because I'm super
because you are
strong.
Going to be fucking yoked.
Yes.
Oh, friends. We hope this put another bunch of sparks in your file. Listen to us when we say, if there is a spark that you would like us to explore, or if you've taken a spark and you fanned it into a flame and you'd like to share that, I hope that you will email us at thesparkfile@gmail.com, or you can submit it through our website, thesparkfile.com.
We will even happily take your feedback, but you know the price of admission. First, you have to share a creative risk that you've taken recently.
And we hope you'll follow us on social media at The Spark File, and be sure to subscribe, rate, and 5-star review this podcast. It really, really, really does help other listeners find us. Mm-hmm. Also, if you like this podcast, we hope you'll share it with people that you love. And if you didn't like it, come on. What's not to like?
Come on. Fuck around and find out. If something tickles your fancy and gets your creative juices flowing, we are writing you a forever permission slip to make that thing that's been knocking at your door. It's your turn to take a spark and fan it into a flame.
You know you gotta take it
and make it.
We're so happy to be back.
Yes, isn't it?
We miss you.
Yes. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thanks for listening and much more to come.
Bye.
Bye.
When I bump into something that inspires me, I dump it in my spark files. Could be something that I wanna make or how I wanna be. I pump it in my spark files. I jump into my spark files. Let's open up the spark files.